Don't mind, I might start. It's slightly early, really, but I've got to go to some meeting immediately afterwards, so I might start. Can I just say again, I do, in a certain way, apologise to people who have to go in the video room. This is a kiss to people in the video room. but I still think it's better to have this kind of setting than the Peacock Theatre, really, so it's just a much more communicative sort of setting, so I'm still going to go on in this arrangement, and I'm still very grateful to everyone for coming. I hope you still stick with it. It gets more interesting, I hope, as it goes on, lecture course. What I'd like to do today is to offer a preliminary critique of Marx's ideas. But I do want to, in a subsequent session, discuss the origins of the 1989 revolutions in Eastern Europe and interpret the disintegration of communism more directly. So what I have to say in the first part of the lecture today concerns mainly what I take to be inherent limitations in Marx's writings at source. Some of these limitations, I think, took a long while to become apparent. They weren't obvious in the beginning. This is partly because the world has changed, partly because the world has changed since Marx's time. Some of these difficulties, I think, became more apparent as a result of changes going on in the wider world. I would like to stop this time, as I promised before, for anyone who wants to ask a question or basically say what I'm saying doesn't appeal to them. I was looking for a roving mic that... Oh yeah, we've got one, so an appropriate point. I'll stop maybe for not more than about 10 minutes, if that's all right, because otherwise I don't have time to cover the material I feel I ought to cover. In the second part of the lecture, I'd like to discuss a countervailing view of modernity, or begin to discuss it, that of Max Weber, because for many people, we've moved out of a Marxian world into a Weberian one. I'll want to say in these lectures this is not the case. This is not, I think, the case. But you need to know what Weber's writings were about, really, before making this kind of assessment. Let's look fairly quickly, anyway, critically at the content of Marx's writings. Remember, I'm talking here primarily about Marx's own work. Remember, in the 20th century, Marxism became an enormously variegated phenomenon. There is no single version of Marxism. There have been probably 20 or 30 distinctively different versions of Marxism in the 20th century. And remember also a point I made in an earlier lecture. Many of the people who are most critical of Soviet Marxism, of Eastern European Marxism, or what's sometimes called Marxism-Leninism, were themselves Marxists. Especially in the 60s and 70s, in Western Europe, there were many people, some of them affiliated indeed to Western communist parties, who were highly critical of the Soviet Union and highly critical of Soviet-style Marxism. So what Marxism is important to stress, has been massively internally both oppositional and contested between different groups of followers. It is not a unitary phenomenon. So I'd like you to bear those qualifying comments in mind. I just want to mention four or five major critical areas of weakness, it seems to me, which we can explore in subsequent discussions. First of all, Marx's writings were based upon the idea of what one could call a cybernetic model of economic organization and governance, especially in a classless society. I mean, I use this term only as a sort of orienting term to explain what I mean by it. Marx had the idea, remember, that markets are irrational and that markets produce numerous contradictory consequences for the societies dominated by them. A market society, for Marx, is an unstable, contradictory, irrational society. mainly because it lacks human intelligence. The main limitation that Marx saw in the extension of capitalistic markets is that it produces a world which is not subjected to human intelligence, which lacks directive control, which breaks, as I put it, the relationship between production and consumption, and thereby creates a world of immense promise where that promise is not realized. Remember, Marx was not a critic of industrialism. Marx was not a critic of the industrial mode of production, which he saw as generating enormous wealth for humanity. He was a critic of the capitalistic way of organizing industrial production, which he saw precisely as contradictory and irrational, and to be supplanted by something else. That something else, of course, was socialism. Socialism, according to Marx, puts the intelligence back into the economic order. The reason I call it a cybernetic model, I mean, that's also a contested term, but what I mean by a cybernetic model is the idea that you can subject lower level economic processes to higher order intelligent control, and that intelligent control will generate both a more efficient economy and a more humane society. That was essentially Marx's version of what socialism could and should do. If you put it very crudely, you could look at it as something like the regulation of a central heating system. If a central heating system in a house or a building, it's regulated through a thermostat, which is a kind of central intelligence mechanism. It switches it on and off as the temperature requires. If you think of a vastly more complicated sort of thermostat, it's a kind of intelligent organization of a system. That's what Marx thought should happen in a modern industrial economy. And I think it made a lot of sense. I mean, Marx was surely right that capitalism is a crisis-prone system. He was surely right that it does involve a fluctuating economy. He was surely right that it creates very large arenas of unemployment, at least periodically. Doesn't it therefore make sense to argue, well, let's subject the economy to conscious human control? That conscious human control would be socialism. Now, when you criticize this idea, as I think now you have to criticize it, you have to recognize that this critique extends beyond Marx. It extends to other versions of socialism too. Because although Marx was a revolutionary socialist, he looked for a revolutionary transformation of capitalism. He shared with all socialists, or at least the major strands of socialism, the idea we need to rationally manage the economy in a conscious way by organized directive control and replace the erratic mechanisms of market capitalism. The whole logic of socialism is based on that assumption. It's turned out to be a heavily compromised assumption. It's turned out, I think, that you simply can't organize, especially global markets, effectively by a cybernetic model of centralized intelligent management. And it even seems, according to recent interpretations of the brain, that the human brain isn't a cybernetic system. You know, Marx sometimes had in mind a model of the human brain with the higher cortical centers directing the lower parts of the central nervous system. The economy in a socialist society would be a bit like that. Even the brain, it seems, probably works, so far as we know, through the input of lots of lower order information systems, rather than simply complete top-down cortical control. Anyway, whether this is true of the brain or not, certainly this model doesn't seem to work for a modern economy. That is, there are strong limits to the degree to which you can subject markets to centralized directive control and still get the benefits which markets provide. A lot of dilemmas for us at the end of the 20th century come from this phenomenon. Now, it seems to me, if you trace this out historically, what's happened is really interesting and really important. There was a period I think you can say, especially for some sort of 30 years or so, around about from the Second World War onwards, when the cybernetic model did have some purchase on reality. This was the period when, if you understand these terms in quotes, Keynesianism worked in the West. It produced a sometimes called welfare state class compromise in the West, a relatively stable form of state-managed capitalism in the West. And you could say that communism, in even heavier quotes, worked in the East because it did seem to produce reasonable levels of economic development and economic transformation. Cybernetic model, it seems to me, only worked relatively well, and you have to say relatively well, in national, when economies were mainly national economies and you could control them fairly substantially, and when people followed fairly habitual and traditional lifestyles. I'd like to propose to you anyway later on in these lectures that over the past 20 or 30 years subsequent to that period, some fairly short period really, from about the early 70s onwards, you get the emergence of a much more global, electronically mediated economy in which you have, we see all around us, fantastic transformations of people's lifestyles which burst asunder the cybernetic model. In a global competitive economy in which you have enormous changes in people's everyday lives across the world linked in with global transformations, the cybernetic model becomes exploded essentially. It simply doesn't work any longer. If you want to call this as the emergence of a global information society, a global market society, but just as important, what I'll later on in the course call essentially a post-traditional society on the level of everyday life. This kind of society seems refractory to centralized management. It seems so on the level of government as well as on the level of the economy, incidentally. I take it this is one of the prime reasons for the collapse of socialism, not just in the sense of the transformation of the East European societies, but the collapse of socialism as economic management system. And I think it has collapsed. That is, you still have, of course, certain low-level planning imperatives. For example, let's have a good transport infrastructure in London. Let's do some work on the tube. Shouldn't the state play a role in this? What you don't have is socialism as, is it were, the beacon of history. Socialism as replacing capitalism. That seems to me, at least as a system of economic management, something which, for better or for worse, we now have to consign to history, along with a particular Marxian version of that. As I said before, many, many dilemmas for us stem from this. A market society seems to depend upon an enormous amount of on-the-ground information, which only immediate producers and consumers can provide, and which you simply can't substitute a central management, intelligent management system for, not in the sense in which traditional socialism anticipated. In subsequent lectures, I'd like to unpack that more and relate it to the collapse of communism and other things going on in our world. The positive side of it is, I suppose, the triumph of classical and neoclassical economics over Marxian economics. I haven't talked about Marxian economics in these lectures because of lack of time. Marxian economics, I think, pretty bluntly, has proved to be false. It was based upon a labor theory of value. It is not true, I think, that labor is the source of value, at least in the late modern world, in the way in which Marx believed. Whatever the source of value is, still controversial in economics, it's not, I think, where Marx sought it. And Marx used this as part of his revolutionary theory of history, because the proletariat was, as it were, the retriever of history, and the proletariat was the source of all value, since all value came from the application of labor power. Those things are not the case. We discover in a market society, therefore, that markets are much more fundamental to our lives than certainly many socialists would have anticipated. And I think the outcome of this, really, whatever you make of it in terms of future possibilities, and I want to talk about this because it's really important later in later lectures, is I think we live in a business civilization for which none of us really were prepared. I don't think the right-wing critics of Marx and socialism believed in the rhetoric that these would disappear in the way in which more or less they have done. I certainly don't think people on the left, and I put myself roughly in this position, anticipated that we would live in a global business civilization without apparent alternatives. But that does seem to be the civilization which at the moment we have created. It's a civilization lacking the dialectic which Marx thought would rescue us, as it were, from the iniquities which he diagnosed within the capitalist mode of production. All that is by way of being a single point critique of the cybernetic model of economic management, which seems at the end of the 20th century essentially to collapse, and we have to take things from there. Second, Marx, I think, never built in adequate protection in his own theory for the ideological use of that theory in the way in which he did diagnose for other ideological systems. Marx, remember, saw bourgeois ideas, such as ideas of bourgeois democracy, liberal democracy, as ideologies. Ideologies defending the position of a dominant class. Ideas which claim to be general are in fact sectional, Marx argued, in many circumstances. He didn't build in, he didn't seem to see the need to protect himself against the same kind of ideological incorporation. And essentially, I think that's what happened, really, you know, with the subsequent history of Soviet-style Marxism. Marxism itself became an ideology of domination. It became an ideology of a system of authoritarian power in the Soviet Union and elsewhere. And this is certainly to some degree because Marx did not have the theoretical purchase, really, to allow him to generalize his own theory of ideology. He anticipated a classless society when there would be an end of ideology. I mean, the idea of the end of ideology, you know, dates from the 1960s, but Marx was one of the first theorists of the end of ideology because he thought ideology would disappear in a socialist or communist society. Doesn't seem to be possible. You need a theory of the relationship between ideas and power in every society, and indeed in subsectors of a society like a university like this one. You need some kind of theory. You need a generalizable account of ideology. Doesn't make sense, I think, to say that ideology would disappear, at least in the sense in which Marx anticipated it would. And I think you need a robust defense of liberal democracy. I mean, I want also to talk about the fate of liberal democracy in subsequent lectures, because we live in a world where capitalism and liberal democracy have triumphed, whereas as the famous American thinker Francis Fukuyama says, we're at the end of history, or seem to be at the end of history. But where each of these is embattled, liberal democracy is plainly embattled. Not many people display much interest in politics anymore. This having been said, liberal democracy is much more robust, much more important, much more central to modernity than Marx diagnosed, I think. All this second bundle is a critique of Marx's political theory of ideology and of democracy. He was too dismissive of what he called bourgeois rights. He was too dismissive of liberal democracy. He thought democracy could be radicalized more easily than it can be. He underestimated, I think, the independent ideological power of the democratic idea, which we see is so important at the end of the 20th century, and democratization is spreading as an idea almost across the whole world. We, of course, have to ask later on, what is the connection between democracy and market capitalism? It's a problematic connection, very problematic connection, but it's plain enough there is a connection. Marx underestimated, however, the independent significance of democracy when he explored that connection, I think. Thirdly, I think there's no doubt that Marx's theory allocated too dominant a position to class and class division. Class played such an important role in Marx because it was simultaneously an account, an empirical account of what societies are like, or at least certain kinds of societies are like, but at the same time a metaphysical account of history. What Marx tried to do was to say, yes, societies are riven by inequalities and conflicts. We see class divisions. Indeed, we do. I mean, this is a society around us in which you could say there is a return of class division, as I might again try to argue later in these lectures. A re-hardening of class divisions arguably is happening in a global capitalistic society of the kind we live in. But Marx didn't want to say just that. He wanted to link the theorem of inequality and class into his account of history, because class for him is also the medium of historical transformation. That's the connection, if you like, between economic theory and Hegel. Transpose Hegelian theory of class showed that the proletarian class was to rescue all of us. Marx called the proletarian class the universal class. It was supposed to stand for the interests of humanity as a whole. That connection, I think, has helped to undermine the cogency of Marx's more empirical analysis of class relations. We do live in class-divided societies, this is true, I think. But class does not have the dominant power that Marx attributed to it, nor does it have, I think, the transformative historical power that Marx wished for. There is simply no global proletariat which is going to make a global revolution, I think. In any sort of late 20th century theory of modernity, I think, has to therefore treat class division alongside other sources of division and power. These include ethnic divisions. Ethnic divisions, as you see from the case of Northern Ireland or Bosnia or many other places in the world, do not simply reflect class divisions. Ethnic conflict is not simply to be inferred from class conflict, whatever relationship might pertain between them. Divisions of gender, of patriarchal power of men over women, do not directly derive from class divisions, which indeed they predate in history, at least using a Marxian concept of class, they do. Divisions of military power and the use of military strength do not come directly from class division. And no doubt there are other dimensions of the social world which cannot simply be reduced, whether they produce conflict or consensus, to class relationships. Marxian theory simply, I think, predicates too much on class. The notion of class has too big a burden to bear in Marxian theory. And in historical terms, this ultimately helped to falsify it, because there is no global proletarian class to make history in the way which Marx anticipated. Fourthly, and this, you can't say Marx was anywhere alone in this, Marx's theory is based, as I mentioned right at the beginning, on giving primacy to industrialism at the expense of capitalism. Marx was not a critic of industrialism. This means in Marxian theory, apart from one or two comments maybe in Marx's very early writings, there is no account of the destructive consequences of industrial development. Marx believed that industrial development would bring wealth to the world, and that wealth would produce a more rounded human life. It would be the basis for a more rounded, creative human existence. We live in a world, I think, as we all see, at the end of the 20th century, where the influence of science and technology is double-edged, and where the influence of industrialism is double-edged. Science and technology, as driven by market imperatives, are perhaps the most dominant forces of change in our lives today. probably even more so than they were in Marx's time, I think. But anyone can see that science and technology and other forms of economic associated with industrialism, while they produce many beneficial consequences for us, also have thoroughly destructive and disturbing ones too. We simply don't know whether the world can even contain the level of industrial development we've achieved so far. It seems highly implausible to suppose that this level of industrial development could be generalized across the whole world, or even generalized to a massive part of it like an industrialized China, without creating enormous problems for the ecological fabric of the planet. It's not surprising Marx did not have an ecological sensitivity. But if you're going to try and use Marxian ideas as relevant to our time, the absence of such an ecological sensitivity is completely fundamental. I mean, as I'll be trying to argue later in these lectures, I think there are, as it were, two versions of modernization around in the world. One is linear modernization of the sort Marx and many other people anticipated, moving from one point, a peasant-type society, to a highly industrial society. That's still going on in the Eastern economies, in the Asian economies. We also have now, increasingly, the second type of modernization, which is modernization carried on under awareness of the contradictory and difficult nature of the implications of high developed industrial production, where at the same time as you produce many, many cars, cars clog up the roads, where at the same time as you have high levels of economic development, perhaps pollution fogs the streets. This second type of modernization is the kind of modernization which will be dominant, I think, in the early part of the next century. And I want to spend quite a lot of time later on in these lectures trying to work out what it is. It's modernization, I think, not post-modernity, it is still modernization, but carried on under very different conditions from those which Marx anticipated, and indeed which orthodox economic theory anticipates too, I think. Finally, fifthly, perhaps the most important of all in a way, but the one you could find sort of least plausible to accuse Marx of in his own day, Marx's ideas are built upon a version of the relationship between Enlightenment thought in the world and the world, which has now proved to be either false or heavily wanting. What I've tried to argue so far in these lectures is that Marx was the prototypical child of Enlightenment, because Marx thought, above all, even more than, for example, a liberal economic theorist would say, Marx thought we could be the masters of our own destiny. What Marx looked for was a rational theory of history, coupled to the cybernetic model of economic management I mentioned at the beginning. This has not, I think, proved to be feasible. And so many issues to do with this second type of modernization I was just mentioning are bound up with the lapse of enlightenment, or what we've discovered to be the limitations of enlightenment. Let me put it in a particular way, because it's very important to me and to most of the ideas informing what I have to say in these lectures. Like many people influenced by the Enlightenment, I should sort of stress for Enlightenment specialists, the Enlightenment was extremely complicated business. There were many sophisticated people who wrote in the early period of Enlightenment. I don't want to wildly overgeneralize about it, even while I in fact do wildly overgeneralize about it. Marx himself, however, had a certain view of Enlightenment, which is based on simple theorem, and I think for a long time it was the theorem of modernity. And it was a very persuasive theorem. It was, the more we get to know about the world, the more we can control the world and shape it to human purposes. The more we get to know about the world, the more we can control the world and determine our own fate. because, so Marx reasoned, in the past, we as human beings have been shaped by history. We have not been the shapers of it. We can become the masters of our own destiny by escaping from the past, from the hold of dogma, from the hold of habit, and from the hold of unthought through tradition. Science and technology will play a major role in helping us do this. There are two aspects to Marx's sort of central golden enlightenment thread, I would say. The first is we have to understand ourselves better. That's the role of economics and the other social sciences. We can control our own history. Second, we have to understand the external world better. That's the role of science. Natural science and technology is the practical way in which we can master that world. I think we see in our period of time that this theorem, while not completely false, has fallen apart. It is not the case that the more we understand about the world, necessarily the more we can control it. It is not the case that in our time we are suffering from lapses in our knowledge. I mean, we have many lapses or limitations in our knowledge. For us, part of the problem has become the very accumulation of our knowledge, whether it's in science and technology or about ourselves, and the implications of that accumulation for our lives. As is easy to see, at least it's easy to see for us living in our time, the expansion of science and technology, for example, produces many new environments of uncertainty which are bound up with that very advance and which are caused by it. The impact of science and technology on the material environment, for example, is simultaneously the origin of what we do understand and control about it, and exactly the source of many new unpredictabilities which we generated about it too. We simply do not know, for example, at least with any degree of certainty, whether global warming is occurring. Many scientists believe it is, just as an example. There is no way to deal with it in terms of pre-existing forms of attempt to accommodate to the physical world and to the climate, because this is a new environment of uncertainty. Part of the uncertainty about global warming is precisely the uncertainty of whether it does exist at all. Now, I'll be suggesting to you later on in these lectures, we face many knowledge environments of this kind. BSE is another illustration of it, but there are many, many examples where the impact of science and technology is, as it were, the only way in which we understand our problems, because we wouldn't know about global warming without the work of scientists. Yet at the same time, the impact of science and technology has actually helped create environments of uncertainty for which there is no historical precedent. Now, I don't think this is in any way confined to the physical sciences. I think this is also true of our attempts to understand ourselves and our own lives. Just as it isn't the case in the external world that increasing knowledge inevitably leads to increasing predictability and certainty, it is not true in our own lives either. In our own lives, the intrusion of knowledge and claims to knowledge, which intrude now, I'll be saying later in these lectures, deep, deep into the heart of the self, deeply into the body, because the body is routinely invaded by technologies of all kinds, social and physical technologies today. In that kind of world, you have new environments of uncertainty which derive from the very accumulation of human knowledge or claims to knowledge, not from their absence. I'll be arguing later this impacts on our conceptions of self-identity. It trawls through our personal life, it trawls through marriage, the family, our relationship to children. All these things display new forms of uncertainty related to the fact that you must constantly reflect on what you do in some sense in order to do it. A society which actually does break with tradition, as the Enlightenment wanted, is a society where you have to decide about many things which tradition decided for us previously. A society which attempts to conquer nature is actually a society where you have to take many decisions about what used to be nature, because these are no longer natural environments at all. This is a world in which there are many decisions to be taken and many new power systems created, but these are extremely difficult for us to master. The old idea, well, let's just get more knowledge and we'll master them, does not work. At least it is not a simple idea in that world, because knowledge claims routinely enter the world, which they describe. As they do so, they restructure that world. That is what our world has become like. If I can take an illustration of that, say you take a decision to live with someone, get married to someone. As you take that decision, first of all, is made against the backdrop of lots and lots of different claims about what's happening to marriage, about what's happening to gender relationships, about various claims to sexual life, about the body. All these things are all around us, popular forms in magazines, in newspapers, television, and so on. You cannot take that decision in ignorance of those things, because we all live in this information environment. But as you take that decision, you in some part reconstitute what that environment actually is. You help reconstitute, you produce a kind of rolling change in the social world which you use that knowledge to describe. This is what it's like to live in a world of high reflexivity. A world of high reflexivity does not obey straightforward enlightenment premises. It's part of the reason why, at the end of the day, as football commentators always say, the Marxian theorem, the sort of crucial Marxian theorem, has been broken apart. Marx argued that we understand history in order to conquer history. He had a particular sort of pithy formulation of this. He said human beings only set themselves such problems as they can resolve. Human beings only set themselves such problems as they can resolve. Crucial to his Enlightenment view of history, because, according to Marx, here you have capitalism marching through our lives, sets us many problems, but at the same time it sets up the resolution of those problems, which is socialism. Human history, I mean, this is a Hegelian theorem in Marx, really. Human history contains the solution to its own problems. All of us, I'd suggest to you, who come from an enlightened background, tend to think this way. Therefore, when you think of global warming, you tend to think, oh God, you know, not that mentioned again. I read about it all the time, totally fed up with global warming. When you read about BSE, you think, well, damn it, I'm going to eat a hamburger. I'm sure there's nothing much in it. That kind of relaxed attitude, well, there won't be much in it, won't be much beef in it either, probably. It's mostly sawdust. I won't mention any brand names, but there is, I think, a strong tendency, if you're schooled in an Enlightenment-type society, to take a relaxed view of the problems which are claimed to exist for us. But in point of fact, we've actually entered a new risk scenario, I think, at our time of history, in which you cannot be sure that human beings have created problems which they can resolve. You can't be sure on the level of the ecological future of the Earth. You can't be sure in terms of the sustaining of global markets, because I think, contrary to some people, there's never been a world electronic global economy of the kind we have now. You can't be sure in marriage, you can't be sure in sexuality, you can't be sure in self-identity. We don't really know whether the world which we have released is a world which will create the sorts of solutions which we hoped it would do, I think. That's why the notion of risk, which I'd like to talk about again in subsequent lecture, is so central to us. The idea of risk is not just a technical idea of economics, it's not just an idea in ecological thought, it is how we think. You can't not think this way in a society where increasingly you must take many decisions about what your life is, about who you are, about how you should live your life, about how you should construct a future, and where we have to take these decisions on behalf of humanity too. The idea of risk is a way of thinking about the future. It's a It's an attempt, if you like, to control future time. And our view of future time can no longer be a linear one, I think. We no longer have a future which we can simply confidently march into in the way in which Marx anticipated. I like to conceptualize this in a preliminary way by saying you have to draw a distinction between a world of external risk or external uncertainty. I shan't, like Frank Knight, recognize a distinction between these. External risk and external uncertainty dominated people's lives until relatively recently, the last several decades, I think, in human history. External risk or external uncertainty was essentially uncertainty created by the fixities of nature and the fixities of tradition, custom, and habit. Nature, for example, caused many uncertainties through bad harvests, climatic unpredictabilities, earthquakes, floods, plagues, and so forth. Tradition was a kind of fixed way in which people lived, at least very often, and expressed itself also as an environment of danger because there were many kinds of traditional habits, for example, military forms of organization, which were a threatening feature of the latter-day world. External risk or external uncertainty is more and more ceding place to what I call manufactured risk or manufactured uncertainty. Manufactured uncertainty is uncertainty created by the very advance of science, technology, and other forms of human knowledge ability. So if you use the theorem I think I mentioned right in the first lecture somewhere, for hundreds of years people worried about what nature can do to us. At a certain point, relatively recently, we started worrying more about what we've done to nature. In terms of the physical aspects of manufactured uncertainty, I take it that's the point of transition between the dominance by external uncertainty to a world increasingly dominated by manufactured uncertainty, where the theorem of reflexivity, as I'll explain later, plays such a crucial part in our lives. Well, I was going to do that in 10 minutes and seem to have been rambling on for about 45, so I think at this point I will stop and allow anyone, or invite, I should say, anyone, particularly in this bit down here, if you don't mind, sorry about privileging this bit down here, but who might like to ask a question or two, and there is a microphone, isn't there, ready round there, so I don't know if anyone's got the inclination, courage, or whatever it takes to ask a question in this somewhat daunting kind of milieu. If not, I'm going to plod on. But you nodding, I should plod on. Oh, mind a question or two. Oh, there's somebody. Working very well, it's high technology. Where's it gone? Well, you might go.
So, regarding the last point, the fifth point on enlightenment, you put the, you blamed in a way enlightenment for this notion of we are in control and this double edge of technology and science.
What do you mean, so on and so forth? No, I mean, you know, I freely admit it. So on and so forth is most of it, really.
Now, my point is, I think that the awareness of this double-edged and the fact that it can become a public discourse is as well a product of the Enlightenment. And so, how do we account for that?
Well, I mean, I think that, to me, that is an example of what I was saying. That is, many things which used to be taken for granted in our lives become part of public discourse. This, of course, included Marxism at a certain point, it still does include it. As these things become part of public discourse, they, however, shift their relationship to us, not in the sense of simply allowing us more emancipation, but in the sense of actually producing an interestingly difficult and convoluted world. I mean, an example I would offer is a discourse of feminism. What did discourse of feminism do? Well, it did a lot of interesting, very important things. What it did, it put into discourse aspects of sexual identity, gender identity, which were previously more or less traditional and taken for granted. So that, for example, Betty Friedan, you know, when she posed her famous questions about women, the main question was the question with no name. That is, women didn't really know who they were. They were not part of public discourse. They were confined within the domestic sphere. Feminism forced the issue of gender identity into discourse and thereby helped to produce many, many changes. This, in the end, also forced masculinity into public discourse, and the last 10 years we see an enormous splurge of books on masculinity and the problem of men now taking its place alongside the problem of women. Now, this, I think, it has emancipatory implications. I mean, it certainly does, and it's certainly produced important changes in the position of women. Some of those changes are very, very positive. On the other hand, putting things into discourse doesn't mean you have the same situation as before plus discourse. You actually have a very different situation in which the question, who am I as a woman, and I think now increasingly, who am I as a man, becomes an existential question for many of us. Now, in the writings that I try to do on these issues, I try to relate this to the body, because I think if a young woman is asking herself a question, what is it to be a woman? What should I aim for? What should my sexual life be? What should my emotional orientation be? How should I relate to my future self? And so forth. This will become a site of highly problematic difficulty. Now, I want to say, on one hand, it's very emancipatory. It is. This is a world where gender revolution is probably the most important revolution, really, the past 30 or 40 years. It's global transformation. On the other hand, it does produce a world where one's relationship to that discourse becomes problematic. And I try to show this. I'm not in any way blaming feminism for this, but bound up with the origins of anorexia and problems of eating disorders, which are bound up with problematic female identity in a world which still accepts that identity on the one hand discursively, but does not accept it in fact, where women are not in fact equal to men, and where the position of women in relation to their bodies is not the same as that of men. You get there's numerous complexities as discourse not just, as it were, floats above the world, but enters into the world all the time and defines in some part what that world is. And I don't think the Enlightenment anticipated that. And I don't think that's consistent with the theorems of Marxism. And I don't think it's consistent with the sort of overall thrust of what the Enlightenment sought to achieve. Now, I don't use that to discredit Enlightenment, because I think modernity is all we've got, essentially. And I think Enlightenment is all we've got. That's why I don't regard myself as a post-modern theorist. But it's produced a much more complicated and difficult world of unmastered change. I mean, a lot of the change that's going on in the world is unmastered change, I think. And the intrusion, expansion of human knowledge is bound up with that unmastered change. So you can't simply say we can resolve these uncertainties by getting more knowledge. That is not really how it works. You need more knowledge. At the same time, more knowledge introduces potentially new environments of unpredictability. I think it's really important, because a lot of these environments do not have an historical parallel. You can trace this out, and I try to do this by looking at history of insurance companies. Insurance companies are all about risk and uncertainty, obviously. They're about attempts to control the future. The most risk analysis in insurance companies is done by actuaries. Now, what actuaries do, they use accounts of past behavior to assess risk. So, for example, if you're a pedestrian walking along the street, you can calculate what your risk of being harmed by a motor vehicle are in the course of a day if you live in a city. Or alternatively, you can calculate the risk every time you step into a plane of the plane crashing, and you can base insurance reparation on that. We now have many new environments of action, however, where you can't make those calculations, because the arenas of uncertainty do not have an historical parallel, and you do not have an historical series for them. That's why an example like BSE is completely an exemplar of this new kind of uncertainty, where in the case of BSE, if you're an insurance company, you do not know what the true risk is, and you cannot calculate it from a past series of calculations of risk. We do not know, for example, in the case of many typhoons and hurricanes that have existed, have come into being over the past 10 years or so, whether they are, quote, natural or not. Insurance companies do not know. There is some indication that the proportion of natural disasters has risen quite steeply over that period. But we don't know if this is because of the transformation of nature as no longer nature. In other words, we don't know whether these result from new forms of uncertainty created by the intrusive impact of science, technology, and industry on the physical environment producing climatic change. We simply do not know. I think insurance companies, therefore, are going to find lots of problems in thinking ahead, which are actually, they just sort of exemplify the problems we all have, as I would see it. We're like in the middle of a great experiment which Marx thought would necessarily go right because of his metaphysical view of history, but which we must recognize can go wrong. I think the great problem for us is the tendency, especially if you brought on Enlightenment culture, to blanket it out. Simply say, oh well, it'll be all right on the day. Oh well, people are scaring us about AIDS. Oh well, people are scaring us about new food additives. Oh well, people are scaring us about the hole in the ozone layer, etc., etc. Things will turn out all right. It's plainly, you cannot make that assumption. That's what it's like to live in a risk-infused culture. It doesn't mean we live in a more risky world than before. It doesn't mean we live in a more uncertain world than people used to live in before. In the Middle Ages, the world was highly uncertain. And, you know, life was indeed nasty, brutish, short, and so forth. We live in a world, different form of uncertainty, where part of the uncertainty about it is precisely it's bound up with us. It's bound up with our own impact upon history. That very impact which Marx thought would allow us to control history, but which creates a situation where we're like in a grand global experiment under uncontrolled conditions. Marx thought the conditions were controlled conditions, but they're not. We're in an experiment. Modernity is a grand global experiment whose consequences we do not know. They may ultimately be beneficial, but they do have, as everyone can see, an enormously important dark side produced by the very impact of the things that Marx thought would resolve history for us in an equitable and humane way. Well, thanks very much. Hope to see you all next week. Thank you.